That's Native American flutist R. Carlos Nakai of Navajo Ute heritage with Ancestral Home from his 1989 album titled Canyon Trilogy. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, June the 17th, and fighters from the Islamic State and Iraq and Syria, also known as ISIS, arrived at the outskirts of Baghdad early this morning. Reports say they're closing in on the city of Baquba, which is about 40 miles north of Baghdad. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is moving more firepower and manpower into the region to prepare for whatever President Barack Obama decides. Dozens of Marines and Army troops have moved in to beef up security at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, and another 100 personnel reportedly are in the region to provide support if needed, the Pentagon said. The aircraft carrier George H.W. Bush and five other warships are now in the Persian Gulf, and more than 500 Marines and dozens of helicopters are on standby. We're talking today about the series that we began. This would be the fifth week of this discussion on America's Fukushima, the largest ecological catastrophe in U.S. history. Investigative reporter Paul DiRienzo has been filing these reports with us on the ecological disaster caused by massive contamination of the Hanford site, I'm mixing up my words today, a sprawling nuclear reactor complex on the Columbia River in south central Washington state. And today, a special program again, just adding more and more as we go on this extraordinary catastrophe that needs to be understood. And thanks, Paul, for being with us again today.
Thank you very much, Eutrice, for this opportunity to inform folks about the America's least known disaster. You know, and hopefully when we educate people, we can find the hope, because it's, you know, although it's a hard job ahead, I think that if we were to get our heads together on this, we could at least, you know, stop the slide and turn things around a little bit.
Well, tell us about where you're going today and our wonderful guest.
Sure. Our guest today is Mr. Armand Minthorn, who's a spokesperson and member of the Board of Trustees of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. He's also a member of the Hanford Advisory Board, which is the stakeholders who are looking at, whose job it is really to oversee the cleanup that's going on in Hanford as we speak. And he's here to discuss some of the historical facts, the importance of the Columbia River, the long, long, long history, long before the settlers, long before the white man, and talking about the impact on the Native people who have lived there for thousands and thousands of years, and the need to really discuss who are the true owners of this land, who are the true stakeholders. And the Hanford Reach we'll be discussing is the 50 miles of the Columbia River, which passes through the Hanford site and which was right now under threat. And we're going to be discussing that with Mr. Minthorn. Welcome, Armand Minthorn.
Good to be here today. Thank you.
Great to have you on. Well, for folks who don't know, because we're here on the East Coast, the Columbia River is the fourth largest river in the United States of America. It has the greatest flow of any river into the Pacific Ocean. It's the home of 14 hydroelectric dams. It's a very heavily developed river. It's 1,243 miles long. And I'm going to send it over to Mr. Minthorn to tell us a little bit more about the significance of the Columbia River and the threats that it's facing and has been facing over the last 70 or 80 years, and maybe even before. So maybe I'll just throw that to you, Mr. Minthorn, and you could tell us why we should be concerned here on the East Coast.
Well, the Columbia River, as we know it today, you know, in our language, our Indian language, we call it Njiwana, which means big river. In Chihuahua, that's what we know the Columbia River by. We've occupied this area in the Pacific Northwest since time immemorial. We were created here. We didn't cross any land bridge. We were created here because this is what our language tells us. This is what our religion tells us. This is what oral tradition tells us. We were created here. The Indian people here in this area have been dependent on the Columbia River in Chihuahua since time immemorial. We harvest our salmon, which is part of our religion. The salmon is sacred to us. The water is sacred to us. This isn't anything that I've made up. This is how it's passed from generation to generation, and it continues today. All along the Columbia River, there's evidence of our Indian people living, archaeological sites on both sides of the river. We have occupied sites that go back more than 11,000 years old. We have archaeological sites on the Hanford Reach that date back 11,000 years. So our existence has always been here. We have always been dependent on the Columbia River. That hasn't changed. Today we are still dependent on the Columbia River. However, the tribes are continuing to work with the states, federal agencies, to clean the river up. The Hanford Reach in particular, because it is the last remaining spawning area in the whole Columbia River. And it's right there at the reach. Mm-hmm. Department of Energy in the early 1940s, during the Cold War, they developed nuclear weapons material at Hanford for the World War II effort. Because of that work, the contamination was left there in the soil, in tanks that are leaking. Some of their shut-down reactors. So the evidence is going to outlive all of us that's there. The radioactive material that's there would be there for thousands and thousands of years. But our biggest concern today is the Columbia River and the contaminants that are reaching the Columbia River.
Mm-hmm. So the contaminants, even although the last reactor was closed in 1987, most of the weapons production happened in the 60s and 70s, early 80s, yet today there's still a threat to the river.
Correct.
And why is that? What is happening to the river right now that we should be concerned about?
The Department of Energy has the task of cleaning up. There are many buildings, there are many sites that still are contaminated with high-level waste, and a lot of this waste is seeping into the ground and reaching the groundwater, and of course the groundwater reaches the Columbia River. But the overall task is cleaning up the Hanford Reservation. We have the state of Washington, we have Department of Ecology, Department of Energy, these agencies that are tasked with cleaning up the reservation. The tribe's role, of course, is important. It's key. Yakima Nation, Umatilla Tribe, and the Nez Perce Tribe, and the Wanapum Band. We are involved with the cleanup effort.
Could you give Mr. Menthorn, could you give us an understanding? Because this is very, very important. These are ancestral lands. Could you give us an understanding as to how these ancestral lands came into the possession of the government so that the government would eventually locate a nuclear site on these ancestral lands?
Well, as related earlier, you know, our occupation has always been in this area. And, you know, in particular, the tribes that we have today still continue to utilize the lands at Hanford. And we have two sacred sites that are on the Hanford Reservation, one that's called Gable Mountain, the other that's called Lalique. And because of these sacred sites, because of our resources that are still there, our foods, our medicines, in particular our fish, which are in the Hanford Reach. So all of these things, as we know today, it's important that us as the tribes continue to remind Department of Energy that we do have rights there. When the treaty was signed in 1855, we did not give away our treaty rights. We retained them in our ceded areas, the Yakama Nation, Nez Perce Tribe, and Umatilla. We retained our treaty rights in those ceded areas, which include Hanford Reservation. And this is why it's important that the Department of Energy, an arm of the federal government, understand how important it is to protect our treaty rights.
Mm-hmm. Could you
go back to what's called the War Power Act, it gave the Army the authority to take the land for World War II effort, and the people were moved off of the lands because of that fact. So, when World War II was over, of course, they left a legacy and contamination, et cetera, et cetera. So, that's how the lands were treated back then because of World War II.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe for us, Mr. Minthorn, the exactly what the treaty rights, give us some idea of what the treaty rights are that the Native peoples claim and are promised. What exactly are those rights?
Our treaty rights are to hunt, gather, and fish at usual and accustomed areas. That's what our treaty rights entail. And when the treaty was signed in 1855, and ratified by Congress in 1857, it gave us that authority and those rights. Mm-hmm. However, the federal government, as they are in the past, as we all know, did not fully honor the treaty. And what ensued after the treaty was signed and ratified by Congress were many wars in the Pacific Northwest because of the migration of the non-Indians here, it only made things worse because the federal government wouldn't honor a majority of the rights or the promises that they made when the treaty was signed in 1855.
What are some of those promises that were broken, just as an example, so we have an idea of it?
Well, after the treaty was signed in 1855, the federal government told our forefathers that no lands would be taken. The lands that people were flocking to take because of the gold that was found, they said that they would not have to worry about people taking other lands. But what ensued after that was the diseases that the non-Indians brought. That was a big impact to our native people back then. They also promised us mills, farms, cattle, farming instruments, homes, etc., etc. A lot of these were not lived up to. But most of all, the lands that were being taken continued to be taken because Congress enacted the Allotment Act, the Dawes Act, and several other acts to reduce our ceded area, to reduce the size of our reservations. Mm-hmm. So there are many, many things that the U.S. government did not live up to after the treaty was signed in 1855.
Right.
I want to ask Mr. Minthorn, the amount of land arrogated to this project that the government took for this project, 586 square miles of it, how much of that represents land taken, of what portion of what you are regarding as ancestral lands, what portion of it was left after the government took its portion to devote to the building of the site?
Well, we ceded away 6.4 million acres when the treaty was signed in 1855. But within that 6.4 million acres, we still retain our treaty rights. Majority of our ceded area are managed by the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, Army Corps, Department of Defense. Majority of those federal agencies we work directly with to help them protect our treaty rights.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about access to the Hanford. There was it was my understanding from the history that after World War II, access was to be allowed back onto Hanford. That access was never granted. Was there any time or period when access was then allowed back onto the Hanford, and is there access today by Native people to go to sacred sites and do things on that area, that use, you know, territories within Hanford reach?
After World War II is over, the Department of Defense still did not allow us access, even though there were traditional camps, traditional fishing sites, and even our burial grounds. So access they did not allow. Up until today, there has been very little movement. However, Department of Energy is working with the tribes. Up until recently, and discussing access. The concern we have today is, if we do have access, what assurance can we have as tribes that if we continue to gather our foods and medicines, are they going to be safe? Will they not be contaminated? This is the question we ask them.
Right. And that's the area I wanted to touch on next, because I had the opportunity to read a study that was, I believe, financed by the Yakima Nation and others, by the University of Colorado. Mr. Dewar Walker estimated radiation doses to tribal fishermen, and according to that study done in 2009, they seem to have showed that there was a tremendous that by pursuing one's traditional lifestyle, eating salmon, using plants, medicines, and other traditional areas, that you would get a larger dose. There was actually the more traditional one lived, the more of a dose of radiation one would get from the plants being contaminated and what have you. Is that true to your knowledge as well?
Yes, that is true. And this is why it's important that not only the public know, but it's important that the federal agencies that are associated with Hanford Reservation understand that the longer there is lack of progress to clean up the river or to prevent the contaminants from going to the river, the more the risk will increase.
And in a way,
but us as tribes today will continue to consume our salmon because it's part of our religion. We'll continue to conduct our ceremonies with the salmon. All of our ceremonies involve salmon. And this is why it's important that these federal agencies understand that we cannot live without salmon. but we have to eliminate, minimize, or control the risk of contamination.
Yes. And which brings up to me, to my mind, it brings to mind the issue of healthcare. Considering the unknown potential of physical damage from exposure to some of these contaminants, are the native people getting the type of healthcare and the type of observation that's necessary to watch and make sure that there are no problems that develop among people? And have there been actual, folks who feel that they have been, physically damaged by this radiation? I mean, are people saying that they have gotten illnesses and diseases that they feel are tracked back to this contamination?
Green run?
Well, there was a suit filed here decades ago from the downwinders, and those people claimed that their lifestyle and the people before them's lifestyle was affected by the contamination that was in the river. So the issue of effects is still continuing today. And the tribes in particular, because we consume more fish than anybody, the attention to tribes and our lifestyle is increasing. Mm-hmm. And the health care is beginning to understand that because of our lifestyle and because it can't change, we have to look at how medicine can help or prevent any illnesses or sicknesses associated with the environment.
Mm-hmm. Are there traditional native medicines, by the way, that can they can help with folks who might feel they were exposed?
Yes, there is.
Could you talk to us a little bit about that? Is that all right?
No, I can't.
That's all right. Thank you, though, for that. So I wanted to talk about the Hanford Reach, because I think a lot of folks don't. I know the Clinton administration in the year 2000. Declared a national monument on the way to being a national park in the area that used to be the security zone around Hanford. And in some ways that is considered a more protected area because people were not allowed on it and development wasn't allowed on it. Is that a double-edged sword? Did Hanford actually lead to the protection of some areas, or is that just a ghost?
Well, this was the tribe's concern, too. To make something a national park is one thing, but to make it a park, something designated as a park, and continue to live with contamination that's still there is another thing. We told these people, along with the National Park Service, that a lot of these idle plants still continue to have contamination underneath, in the ground, that is continuing to pose a risk or increase the risk to the Columbia River. So that sometimes the mighty dollar is louder, and, in spite of that, the Park Service now, today, I believe, has a park or a building there that's under their jurisdiction to document and or acknowledge the history of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Thorne, can I ask a question here for a minute? The scenario that I'm getting is that the tribes that are living in that area, in their ancestral lands, I'm asking really what legal challenges have you made against the government as several nations living in that region, consisting of recognizing that there is contamination, which you believe there is, that it's having a a major impact on your way of life. It continues to have an impact on your way of life. And at the same time, it also is in breach of a treaty. The treaties have not been honored. So is there a history of legal battle that you have waged on this question, on these questions?
No, there is not. However, the legal aspect that we work with today is sometimes a balancing act, and you know, there's pros and cons of any kind of legal action. And if there's an intent, even the thought or mention of intent can really change attitudes and or positions. And that is so true. But the legal aspect that the tribes have, we know what we have. And if there's going to be any legal action or thought of any legal action, it has to be thought out very carefully. But the authority that the Treaty of 1855 has cannot change. The only change any treaty can go through is through Congress. The federal government has no authority. Federal agencies do not have authority to abrogate and or take away treaty rights. Only Congress can do that. So, again, you know, as a final note with the legal aspect, we know what that authority is, but we have to be very cautious whenever that discussion comes up, because we certainly don't want a battle that we don't want to win.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I wanted to step back a little bit and look at a related issue, because I was very concerned when I heard about the damage that was discovered at the Wanapum Dam, which is just 20 miles north, and brought into mind sort of like the focusing issue that we've been using to on these programs we've been doing about Hanford has been the comparison to Fukushima, and in that way the comparison is the potential of natural disaster and or unnatural disaster in a sense of a man-made dam, a hydroelectric dam, failing, and a wave of water coming down through the river was a frightening. Fortunately, that did not happen. The waters were removed behind the dam, but it brought up a couple of issues, because I know that there was a tremendous issue. We touched on it earlier about remains that were found by anthropologists and scientists and archaeologists that were then removed from their sacred site. Is this a continuing problem of scientists and academics coming into native territories and basically stealing, you know, bones and other ancestral things? Is this an ongoing problem, or is this under control now?
It is not under control, and it is a big problem. You know, we have state laws and federal laws that protect ancestral burial grounds and our archaeological sites or ancestral remains. The bigger problem we have today is with the pot hunters and the looters. The biggest, and it's sad to say, the biggest item on the black market and the hottest item on the black market today is Indian skulls. That's a fact. And as we work today to protect our sacred sites, our burial sites, our archaeological sites, this is why we need partnerships with those federal agencies and those state agencies and those counties and the people that operate those dams. We have to have a partnership. The more effort, the more hands there are to protect, the better. The tribes cannot do it alone. Even though we have federal and state laws on our side, we still cannot do it alone. This is why it's important that we have a working relationship. We cannot burn any bridges when it comes to protecting sacred sites.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed I believe it was the Army Corps of Engineers, but they this time when the trouble happened at the dam in February, federal forces actually moved in to protect the areas and allowed only access to the native people. Is that true? Was it a good relationship this time?
That is true. And it is a good working relationship. Mm-hmm. Because who better to treat and care for ancestral remains and or archaeological sites with a drawdown than the Indian people? Who better to do that? They understand more than the non-Indians. They understand more what they mean to us and why they have such big meaning with us. And the partnership with the Public Utilities District Dam, Wanapum, is a good working relationship. They had cooperation from the federal agencies and state agencies and the county as they monitored the shore. And, of course, there were looters out there. There were looters out there illegally, taking and ransacking burial sites and archaeological sites. And they did get it under control.
Mm-hmm. Good. There's a couple of questions about the history. You mentioned the Wanapum Dam, and I find it fascinating, and I don't know if that's the area, but the Wanapum people were not covered by the Treaty of 1855. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Why was it that they are not covered, the one group is not covered by that treaty? What is being done to make sure that their interests are protected?
The Wanapum Band, they were the only band that refused to move to a reservation. They were the only peoples and band that refused to sign a treaty. They firmly believed that where they lived right now today at Priest Rapids, that this is their home. This is where we lived for countless generations, and this is where we will continue to stay. The Wanapum Band are represented because through the federal government, through what they call enrollment with other tribes. Mm-hmm. There are many families that are either enrolled at Yakima Nation or Warm Springs in Central Oregon, even here at Umatilla. So there is a connection there. But the Wanapum Band today, where they live, is where they have always lived since time began. And that's what they told the Public Utilities District when Wanapum and Priest Rapid Dam was built. We will not move.
Right. What is the... Go ahead.
Sorry. I wanted to ask, you said something earlier stood out to me. To what degree is your experience, the experience of many other First Nations along major rivers where other nuclear plants had been built, what is your sense of the complexity of this problem? This is not the only situation, but there are others like it. Do you have a sense that there are other nations dealing with exactly the same issues that you are?
I'm sure that there are. Throughout the nation, the United States, I'm sure that there are other tribes and bands that have similar and even complex issues and problems, especially in association with a tributary or a river, even along the ocean. I'm sure that there are. And this is why it's important, because you know, wherever Indians come from, a majority of them will say, this is where we were created. And because of that, their association with the land, their association with Mother Nature, whether it be the water, the mountains, what have you, it's always been there. And it's inherent that through their language, their foods, their customs, and their traditions, that they protect it. And this is where it gets complex in working with state and federal laws. Some of them do help tribes, but the tribes have to take the initiative to increase the advantage with those laws.
Let's start moving towards the future and talking about what the future holds. This cleanup is obviously going to go on for generations, and there'll be hopefully, you know, the monies will be there for a continuing cleanup long into the next generations, which is unfortunate, but at the same time hopeful if the money is there and the cleanup continues and it is successful. What is your feelings about the future? Do you have trepidation, or do you feel hopeful that that the problems at Hanford will be properly dealt with? I've talked to a lot of people, and there's generally a general lack of hope, and I was just wondering what your feeling was.
Well, there can only be hope, and people with less than that, you know, that's okay. But it's not that we don't want to work with those people that have less hope, because it's going to take a combined effort. I know that the contamination at Hanford is going to be there when I'm gone. It'll be there when you are gone. That's why it's important that the cleanup at Hanford continue to go forward and progress. And understanding that money talks, and Congress appropriates that money in many instances for cleanup at Hanford. This is why it's important that tribes maintain their foresight, looking ahead, planning ahead. We only have today what we have is because of the people before us. Would want to have the same kind of words expressed by the people ahead of us. I hope that they'll talk about us today in a good way, what was done in this generation, because the people before us worked, and we have what we have today because of that work. So that's how it goes generation to generation. And it doesn't matter if it's clean water or fish. But what's important for Indian people is that our traditions and customs continue with the foods that are sacred to those traditions and customs. Mm-hmm. And to be hopeful, this is why we have to be hopeful. We cannot give up as Indian people.
Mm-hmm. There was seemed to be last September, last fall, when I was out in Richland in the area, people were talking about a very large salmon run, the largest in memory. And was that hype, or do you think there's really a return of salmon, or is that just a one year sort of something unusual, or is that something that's a trend for the future, hopefully?
It's not hype. We have good runs and we have low runs. But what's important is that the Yakama Nation, Umatilla Tribe, Nez Perce Tribe, Warm Springs Tribe, we have all these fish programs in the tributaries, John Day, Yakima River, Umatilla River, Walla Walla River, Snake River, Clearwater River, all of these tributaries, we have fish strengthening efforts through acclimation ponds. We are growing our own fish, and we release them into tributaries. they come back. And as an example, here in the Umatilla River, on the Umatilla Reservation, we lack salmon in the Umatilla River for over 75 years. Now we have salmon returning to the Umatilla River, which we've never had. And it's because of our working with the irrigators, the states, and the federal agencies. So this is an effort in strengthening not only our culture, but strengthening our way of life when we can put back in the river what belongs there.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Minthorn, are you feeling comfortable with the idea that the fish that you eat and the medicines that you gather and the hunting that you do, all of these things to sustain your lifestyle today, do you feel comfortable with the idea that the food is wholesome and free of radiation?
Yes. We, as Umatilla Tribe, have 6.4 million acres that we can gather, hunt, and fish. In that 6.4 million acres, a lot of our resources are still pristine and clean. However, on the Hanford Reservation, it's different. And this is why the tribes have to be a part of the cleanup at Hanford, so we can not only be assured, but we can as well have the capability to test our foods and medicines to ensure that they're clean.
Do you test them? Do you have the facilities for testing them?
We have some growing facilities now. Mm-hmm. Our technology and our learning curve has increased, and we will eventually have that capability with science to test our foods and our medicines.
So to protect the traditional way of life with the most modern technology available.
Yes, sir.
Very interesting. There's so many questions. We don't have that much more time. It's been a great discussion. I think I wanted to, just on the way out, I can't wait to get out west again later this summer and in the fall maybe and have salmon dinner. Is there any place you suggest I should go?
Yes, sir. You can come directly to our Longhouse Reservation. Our Longhouse is our church. This is where we carry on our traditions and customs.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And anything you would like to add to wrap up, things that people should know about the relationship of Native people, First Nations people to the land in the northwestern United States? What should we know? Anything you'd like to add?
Ignorance is choice. Ignorance is choice, and people choose not to know, and that's their choice. It would be best if people would come to understand how other people live. That would most help in how people get along with each other. But that would be a note and would be a message, is ignorance is a choice. And we can still choose not to be ignorant.
Very good. And any last questions, Chitrice?
I just wanted to get a sense of how do you feel about the relationship of this, of the identity of a cultural identity today within the context of how you are defined, quote unquote, by the federal government. How is identity holding up within the Wampum or within the Nez Perce and within the Yakima?
Our identity is very strong. The federal government does have a sense and some understanding of how we live and why we live the way we do. But they will never completely understand. But our identity, our culture, our language, our way of life is still strong within all of these tribes and bands. And we'll continue to do that as long as we have the capability. So whatever the federal government says, you know, in part, has to be taken with a grain of salt, because a lot of them do not come out here to see, to hear, and to taste how Indians live. They don't do that. So they have a misconception many times, but to lessen that misconception and to lessen that ignorance, it would be good if they could actually come out and visit us.
Mm-hmm. And they don't. You have it.
What is
your connection as far as, I know obviously there's folks who I've run into who work for the government who seem to be pretty committed to the cleanup and to working with the Native people, and I was impressed by that. At the same time, at the higher levels, has the head of the DOE ever come out? Have you visited and met with Mr. Moniz, the director of the DOE at all?
He came out here to the Northwest, I believe, several months ago when he first started his office as secretary. So he does have a memory in working with Hanford because he was an assistant secretary in the mid-90s. So he does remember the tribes, and he does remember the challenge here. But Mr. Moniz is coming out again, I believe, this fall. And we intend to meet with him and to express to him as well over again how important it is to have a government-to-government with tribes and the reasoning behind that government-to-government to protect what's important to mm-hmm. the tribes.
That's key. And maybe we'll leave on this note and discuss in a minute or two more the idea of government-to-government relationship. When Native people deal with the United States government, they're not dealing as a stakeholder or as another group or as a citizens group, but actually as a government of independent people dealing with another government.
Correct.
Interesting. How does that complicate matters or make them easier or more complicated?
Both. It can make it easier and it can make it complicated because there are federal agencies that have a different understanding of what government to government is. Some federal agencies think a phone call is consultation or government to government, or writing a letter is government to government. And we tell them, no, government to government is when we sit down at the same table across from each other and talking and trying to reach agreement or consensus on an issue or concern. That's government to government. And it does not end. It never ends. And the federal government, all federal agencies are supposed to have a document that directs their government to government relationship. Some use it, some don't. And that's the problem.
I see.
How can people learn more, Mr. Minthorn, about what it is you're doing and the various bands around the river, how they are attempting to just get the situation rectified and what it is that you do?
Well, one of the best points of connection would be directly to the Hanford office. And Doug Shoup, he's the acting site manager today. He would be the best one to talk to about tribes and Department of Energy and our relationship. But each of the tribes in Nez Perce, Yakima Nation, and Umatilla, we all have our own websites.
And those are easily, you can find them by just searching the name of the nation or the tribe, and they pop right up. That's how
correct.
I found Mr. Minthorn. Very good. Again, last moment, anything you'd like to add?
No, sir.
Thank you very much. Armand Minthorn, spokesperson, member, Board of Trustees, Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, member of the Hanford Advisory Board, who has brought us up to speed on some of the most crucial issues of our time. Thank you so much for joining us on Lead Stories.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great. And Eutrice, I'll throw it back to you. Any final comments between you and me in these closing minutes?
Well, I thought this was very, very insightful because, of course, this is not a conversation that normally is heard on any regular radio. And we talked with the people who are literally the first folks at the river. And this is a point of view that has been missing from this whole discussion. So it was great to be able to talk with people and get their insights. I mean, some of the things may seem a bit surprising, for example, that he seems particularly amenable to cooperating with government and so forth. But then you understand the philosophy behind it, and it's very different from the quote, typical Western way of thinking, unquote. But
in the sense that we are, when we act, we're citizens of the United States who are pressuring and redressing our government for grievances. That's a lot different than when a foreign or another country comes to our government and says, what about this problem between us? Much different situation.
Very interesting. Secondly, I thought it was very important that that Amon Minthorn talked about the strength of identity still persisting despite every incentive to just say, the heck with it. You know, we don't need to be bothered with this, but this is a sacred duty, and they are very serious about it. That was very important. But more than anything, the fact that they are at front and center of this discussion and therefore deserved and still do deserve the opportunity to really put the whole thing into context. So that was a really good piece of work today.
And that technology and science are now being put in the hands of people to regain their traditional lifestyle is fascinating to me as well.
That's great. Good
Thank
work,
you, Trace,
Paul.
For this opportunity.
Thanks a lot for being with us today and for bringing this information to us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program, and I hope that it was insightful to you and that we all learned something. As Amon Minthorn said, ignorance is choice. So the information is available. It helps us see this question, this catastrophe in a yet another dimension. And it also puts into the mix the very important points of a very important a group, the people most affected by the building of this nuclear reactor on the Columbia River. And we see how a decision really interrupts centuries of life. And we see how long-lasting in many instances it can be. So this is why I say all the time, every story, you try to find the context of it in order to understand the fullness of the story. Please do drop me a line. Let me know whether these things are resonating with you. Drop me a line at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Keep it right here. Up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. And a great program planned for you tomorrow. Please do meet me at 1 p.m. It's a pleasure and privilege to be in your company.